This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. We've heard in recent years about the efforts to get antiretroviral drugs to people in Africa who are HIV positive, but the plague of AIDS continues to kill. In journalist Johnny Steinberg's native South Africa, more than one in eight people are HIV positive. He reports some 800 South Africans die of AIDS on an average day. The thought of millions of his countrymen not being tested for HIV, not availing themselves of antiretroviral treatment, and succumbing to AIDS deeply disturbed him. He wanted to know why. The question led him to a rural South African district of Eastern Cape Province and a young man who Steinberg calls Sizwe Magadla, a key figure in Steinberg's book, Sizwe's Test, A Young Man's Journey Through Africa's AIDS Epidemic. Johnny Steinberg is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He is an award-winning journalist and the author of three books. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University. He's worked as a journalist for a South African daily newspaper, written scripts for television drama, and served as a consultant on criminal justice for the South African government. His new book, Sizwe's Test, A Young Man's Journey Through Africa's AIDS Epidemic, is published by Simon & Schuster. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Johnny Steinberg, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks, good to be here.
What is South Africa's Eastern Cape province like, and the district you traveled to where you met Sizwe?
Well, it's a strange combination of things. It's on the southeastern seaboard of South Africa. And in the apartheid days, Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd in the 1960s, grand idea to separate black and white. The northeastern reaches of the Eastern Cape housed what he designated were independent black homelands, and they were really dumping grounds for unwanted labor. They were very, very poor. They're overpopulated, very few services. That was in one half of the province. The other half was part of white South Africa with a very, very good infrastructure, a large middle class, sort of urban and industrial world you'd find anywhere in the first world. So it's a province of quite extraordinary contrasts. You can drive 100 or 200 miles, and it will be as if you've crossed from one end of the earth to the other.
Why did you choose to go there then? Because it was such a land of contrasts?
I went because I was looking for an antiretroviral treatment program that was working very well in a rural area. And I wanted to see what that meant to the meaning of AIDS among ordinary people. And I found a treatment program run by Doctors Without Borders, MSF, in conjunction with Eastern Cape government, in a rural town called Lusikisiki. Lusikisiki is deeply rural, very, very populated, about 150,000 people, in one of these old apartheid homelands, which was called the Transkei. Very high levels of AIDS. The prenatal rate of AIDS was nearly 1 in 3, nearly 1 in 3 pregnant women testing HIV positive. But distinguished by the fact that it had this extremely good ARV program, and I wanted to see how people responded to that program. Did they come and get the medicine? Did they stay at home, even if it was available? And if they stayed at home, why did they?
Why was this program working well?
Well, the South African government has a patchy and complicated history with antiretroviral medicine. Our president, Thabo Mbeki, famously in 2001 began questioning whether HIV caused AIDS and argued not only that ARVs perhaps weren't an answer, but that they were toxic and added to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So there was huge denial in governments and a backlash against this medicine. And when government eventually did concede under pressure from a very powerful social movement to begin distributing antiretroviral medicines, it insisted on doing it only at hospitals and only administered by doctors. And Doctors Without Borders said that you can't do it that way when the epidemic is so extensive and when doctors are in such short supply as they are in South Africa. These medicines must be administered by nurses and lay people and at grassroots level, not at hospital level, just at ordinary clinics, ordinary places and villages. And that's what they set about doing in Lesiki-Siki. It was nurses administering the medicines, not doctors, and it was happening in very rudimentary clinics rather than hospitals, and that seemed to be working.
Yeah. Back to Thabo Mbeki, the statements he made in the past about AIDS, can you help us understand where that came from?
Well, I mean, many Americans understand him as some sort of African traditionalist, and that's probably not the way to begin. He's educated in the United Kingdom. He understands himself as a skeptic and a rationalist, and he believes that there was a prejudice at the heart of Western scientific exploration of death in Africa. I mean, what he heard was this. He heard the West saying to Africa, you're sick. The reason that you're sick is that your men are oversexed and can't control their sexual appetites, and we're going to save you with our drugs. That's the message he heard. It was the wrong message to hear. It was absolutely tragic that he denied the connection between HIV and AIDS. He provided appalling leadership. But I think what was happening is that he was seeing things through a historical lens, and he's right that Western science has often misdiagnosed African illness, and it has done so because of quite deep racist assumptions. I mean, a classic example in South Africa is tuberculosis. At the turn of the century, Black South Africans were dying of tuberculosis in great numbers, and whites weren't. And medical scientists asked why. They asked whether there was a genetic predisposition among Black people. And an obvious answer only came much later, which is that essentially the conditions of industrialization in South Africa were impoverishing people, putting people in the sorts of overcrowded and damp environments that spread the bacillus. So he was thinking there's a long history of white people misdiagnosing disease among Black people. And I guess it was a comforting thing for him to think that it was happening again, because he just inherited a young democracy that he'd spent his life fighting for. And the idea that he inherited a country where people were dying en masse was very difficult for him. And it's a great tragedy of his leadership.
Yeah. That brings me to ask you about this. There are so many layers to this story, and two important matters are sex and race, and these issues you bring up. At the very outset of your book, in the preface, you write about the defeat of apartheid and all the hope that ensued. And you write, a new democracy is an era of resurging life. Sex is the most life-giving of activities. That a new nation's citizens are dying from sex seems to be an attack both on ordinary people's and a nation's generative capacities, an insult too ghastly to stomach. So, would you want to expand on that? You want to put some more flesh on that?
Well, it's a big one to unpack, and maybe a way to do it is to introduce the main character in the book and talk about it through him. I went to Lesiki-Siki to check out this program, and I met a young man whom I've called Sizwe Magadla. He was 29 years old, and I met him. And what distinguished him is really his success. He was charismatic, good-looking, and economically successful, which is very unusual in his village. He was running an odds and ends shop in South Africa. It's called a spaza shop. It sells everything from bars of soap to beer to raw chickens, anything you can think of. And he was doing pretty well. He was accumulating some money. He believed deep down inside that he had HIV. He said that he felt that his blood was contaminated, and yet he wouldn't go and test. Mm-hmm. And he and I toured the antiretroviral treatment program in his district. We went from clinic to clinic and saw before our own eyes that these drugs really worked. We met people at death's door, and over the coming weeks and months watched the flesh return to their bones, watched their skins heal. And yet despite this evidence, he still wouldn't test. And the book became something of a conundrum. Why is an evidently happy, well-adjusted, self-preserving person behaving this way? And, I mean, without trying to push the meaning too far, I think he stands as something of a metaphor for our country, for South Africa. You know, in a momentous battle, beat apartheid. Very, very unfortunately, are stuck with this plague at the dawn of a new era, and we're not dealing with it very well. Infection rates are not going down. We haven't had the sort of national conversation which can end or curtail the epidemic. And I guess I wanted him to stand as a parallel for, you know, an individual and a nation facing similar sorts of issues.
Yeah. What were his dreams, and what worried him when you met him back in the spring of 2005?
Well, what was most interesting is what he was doing with his money. He was saving up to marry. Very few men in that area could afford bride wealth anymore. And he could. So he was going to marry, and the biggest meaning for him around that is that he was going to have children who would bear his name. Again, which would make him very unusual in that area. And I remember once standing outside a clinic with him late in the afternoon, and a woman walked out, and he said to her, "Are you an HIV counselor?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Does that mean I can test for HIV?" And she said, "Yes, you can do it right now, we can go inside." And he recoiled and said, "No, I'm not going to test now, and I'm never going to test." And I said to him, "Why not? Why will you never test?" And he said, "If I were to test positive, if there were this poison in my blood and in my semen, you know, the woman I'm going to marry, I'd have to send home to her parents. The child in her womb would end up with her parents and would not be my child. I would not be able to marry because I'd risk poisoning the next generation. And if that was the case, I would have lived the life of an ox. I would have labored for some time and then dropped dead and left nothing on the earth but my corpse." And that was a very powerful moment for me. You know, he was saying what he was doing with his life was leaving a legacy by having children. You know, that's what his masculinity, his manhood meant to him. And to have this contamination in his blood and his semen would destroy that. So I think that, you know, in that sense, HIV really attacked him at the very heart of who he believed he was.
Yeah. So because he told you, I think I would test positive, I think I have this, he was then at risk of HIV infection before he met this woman who was going to be his wife?
It was complicated. I mean, he believed that if this contamination was in his blood and if he knew it was there, it would kill him, that the knowledge itself would kill him, and that perhaps his ignorance of having it would hold it at bay a little longer. Not very rational thoughts, but psychologically very powerful thoughts.
Yeah. Well, denial is a universal issue, is it not?
Yeah. Well, denial is universal, and this idea of a contamination which is both physical and moral, that's also pretty universal. You know, when a disease is transmitted by sex and is potentially fatal, it brings out difficult moral issues in any culture, even the culture which on the surface appears to be sexually sophisticated. As Sizwe's is, in fact, it's not a sexually primitive or uptight culture, it's a fairly sophisticated one. But when a virus comes along and transmits death through sex, it's very, very difficult to separate the physical from the moral contamination. They just get entwined, as they did in Sizwe's mind.
Yeah. So shame is a big complicating factor here.
Yes, it is. And it relates back to his success. He was very, very worried of other people's jealousy. You know, in the first months that I was with him, to go back a step, this is an area of the country where belief in witchcraft is pervasive, where Sizwe, along with everybody else around him, believed that his enemies could potentially kill him using occult means by sending a demon, potentially, for instance, to have sex with him in his sleep and transmit HIV to him. So he believed that he was under some sort of threat. He was thriving. People were jealous of the fact that he was thriving. And that was his first reason for being reluctant to test for HIV. It's very difficult to keep that test confidential in a face-to-face environment. And he believed that if his enemies knew he was HIV positive, he'd somehow lose this invisible shield around him, that his good health and other people's knowledge of his good health was a shield against envy. But as I spent more time with him, this jealousy became a lot more complicated. And it mingled with his own sense of shame, his own worry that in doing successful, he was putting other people down. And by the end, it became very unclear whether this hostility towards him came from the outside, from others, or was in fact levels at by himself, at himself. And that's completely fed the idea, the sort of presumption he had that his blood might be contaminated. It really became, you know, was it physical? Was it a sense of shame? Was it a sense of guilt? All these things became entwined with one another.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Johnny Steinberg. His native South Africa, in his native South Africa, more than 1 in 8 people are HIV positive. He reports that some 800 South Africans die of AIDS on an average day. And the thought of that led him to ask the question, why? And that question led him to a rural South African district of Eastern Cape Province and a young man who Steinberg calls Sizwe Magadla, a key figure in the book Sizwe's Test, A Young Man's Journey Through Africa's AIDS Epidemic. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read your book, but in deference to President Mbeki, who's a very knowledgeable, intelligent, and experienced man, there is a report that has never been contradicted in the London Times that AIDS originated in Africa because of an experimental medical vaccine that had been developed by the World Health Organization involving a retrovirus, and they decided to test it out on black people in Central Africa. Now, I've never read any contradiction of that report anywhere, and it was in the London Times. I'm wondering if your book, since you're looking about why, did you get into that report? Thank you.
Well, the idea that AIDS was spread by needles has been present at times, and it certainly can't be ruled out. The book doesn't deal with it. The book is a narrative story about one man and not a commentary on the science. And I'm no expert on the science. You know, I can tell you what orthodoxy is saying at the moment. And I mean, the most prevalent position at the moment is really that it was, it was transferred initially from animals to people in about the 1930s in the jungles of Central West Africa. Really, as a result of modernization, when an animal form of the virus had probably been around there for many, many generations, and it was only once a modern process began penetrating the jungles and people came into contact with animals with the virus that are transferred. But certainly it's a possibility that can't be ruled out that it was accidentally transmitted arm-to-arm through needles, through careless medical practices. That's a live possibility.
Mm. And certainly Dr. Herman Reuter and Doctors Without Borders have faced this challenge of the idea that being pricked, being tested, gives one HIV. How have they answered those kind of challenges?
Well, to give your listeners some background, Herman Reuter was the head of the MSF project in Lusikisiki. He arrived to bring HIV medicine to the area. The first thing he found is that the nurses in the clinics, who were meant to be in the front line administering the treatment, were in denial. They said there's no AIDS epidemic here. And his first task was to show them that there was. So he went from village to village with nurses, conducting voluntary testing himself. And the first that people saw of him in the villages was a white man pricking people with a needle. And very soon, rumors spread throughout the villages that this man had brought AIDS in his needle. And a very specific developed conspiracy theory emerged, which is that white people wanted to decimate the black population until they could win the general election by a democratic vote. That idea about Herman Reuter spread. He was confronted on two occasions in full clinics, and people said, "We're not here to test, we're here to ask what you're doing here." And he stood up in a chair, performed the test on himself, trying to explain the science of it as best he could. But ultimately what happened is the people who came to him first were those who were so sick that they had nothing to lose. And these are small face-to-face communities, and everybody watched. And generally they saw that his medicine was benign and powerful. They saw people at death's door get better. And slowly he gained legitimacy. And by the time he left, he was there four years. He got a hero's farewell. So there was a very, very difficult time, but it did pass.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Johnny Steinberg. We're talking with him about his book, Sizwe's Test, A Young Man's Journey Through Africa's AIDS Epidemic. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. So how did you and Sizwe talk about this idea of evil spirits?
Well, at some point he said to me, you're white, you don't believe in these things, do you?
Mm-hmm.
We were driving in the car, and I took my eyes off the road for a second to put a CD in. I swerved for a moment and straightened and apologized. And he said, I think that was the spirit that was trying to harm us. I said, no, I just took my eyes off the road. That's all that happened. And he said, you don't believe in magic, do you? And I said, no. And he said, do you believe that people like me are stupid to believe in magic? And I said, no, do you believe I'm stupid not to? And in the end, I mean, what I said to him is that I think what's real is envy and jealousy and anger, and that they can do enormous damage. But I don't think you can damage somebody just by willing it or just by thinking about it. And we agree to disagree. You know, this is something which he was born to, and which is very much in the air he breathes. I don't think there was space for any rational debate between us on this issue. It's just I come with a set of assumptions and he comes with different ones.
Yeah. I've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us, and so I'm going to ask a question, and then we'll go to our listener in Urbana and Eureka, our listeners. Maybe you tell us just a little bit about diviner healers and their role in life in this part of the world.
Well, it's believed that one's ancestors are looking over one. When somebody dies, they get installed in the world of ancestors and watch you from the spirit world. And an ancestor can bring you harm if you do bad by them. And generally what an ancestor wants is to perpetuate his lineage. So there are four crucial moments in life that an ancestor is very concerned about, and those are birth, marriage, initiation into adulthood, and death. And one has to perform the right rituals and sacrifice to the ancestors in the right way at those points. And if something goes wrong at any of those points, one can incur the wrath of ancestors. The role of a diviner healer is somebody who falls sick, usually in childhood. Usual medicines don't heal them. They end up being chronically sick. And it's decided at some point that the reason they're sick is that their ancestors have called them to mediate between the dead and the living. And when that happens, they surrender to this illness and join a diviner healer's retrainee and go through a long process of learning. It's 2, 3, sometimes 4 years of becoming a diviner healer. And the aim of that training is firstly to stop the sickness, but to stop it through surrendering oneself to the spirit who's calling one. And when once that's happened, you are a qualified diviner healer and you are permitted to take clients. That's essentially in an idealized description, that's the function of a diviner healer.
Mm. And what has been their role in terms of the acceptance and the challenging of and the acceptance of clinics?
Well, it's been complicated. In principle, there shouldn't be a clash between traditional healers and clinics, because generally people visit both. People are very, very experimental when they're ill. It's very unusual for somebody to choose a clinic over a traditional healer or a traditional healer over a clinic. So if there was good communication between medical practitioners and traditional healers, things would be fine. There are two complications. I mean, the one is that when there's so much illness around, when this AIDS epidemic is around, many entrepreneurs come in to try and make a quick gap, back and take the gap. So since the AIDS epidemic, all sorts of people have been standing up saying they're traditional healers and they can cure AIDS, and people go to them for a while until it's proved that they're frauds. Another problem is that it really comes from the government. President Mbeki's health minister, a woman named Mansour Shabalala Msimang, also, like Mbeki, deeply skeptical of antiretroviral medicines, has said to people that if they're uncomfortable with ARVs, they should go to traditional healers. And in a place like Lusiki-Siki, the way that's interpreted is to say, well, what the health minister is suggesting is that perhaps this is caused by sex, but perhaps by witchcraft. And if it's witchcraft, then we should go to a traditional healer. So government policy and government utterances have divided traditional practice from medical practice in ways that's very difficult to heal. Mm.
Let's take these calls now. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi. Line one? Okay, let's go to Eureka, line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was thinking about how difficult AIDS is to deal with in this society, and then given some of our religious difficulties and other understandings about homosexuality, I'm wondering, in the view of your guest, does it seem like the dealing of this issue or its playing out in Africa, and I realize this is a subjective judgment, is a much more difficult thing there than it is here?
Well, thus far, it has proved a lot more difficult. If you look at the gay epidemic here in the 1980s and compare it to the heterosexually transmitted epidemic in South Africa now, you know, really within 5 years, by about 1985, the gay community had, with little help, changed sexual practice and pretty much halted the epidemic or contained it, which, you know, by comparative standards is remarkably quick, and we just haven't been able to do the same. You know, we're now deep into the epidemic. It's been around many, many years. We've had deaths everywhere, and we haven't been able to change sexual practices. The infection rate keeps being very high. And I think that the problem is less religion and culture than politics and the history of a society divided very brutally by race. I think that black men in South Africa, generations of black men in South Africa, experienced racial domination primarily as a process of emasculation, of having a position as patriarchs very slowly and painfully taken away from them. And the result is that, you know, to talk about sex and sexual practice now is very, very hard. It's very loaded. It's almost like it touches a wound. And, you know, we've had two presidents in the post-apartheid era, Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, and in their own ways, both failed to deal with this. Mandela was very coy in talking about AIDS, and he didn't, and he now regrets it. You know, Mbeki questioned whether there was a link between sex and death at all. We have a prospective president, Jacob Zuma, who's also struggling to deal with this issue. So we're coming from more than a cultural legacy, a political legacy, which makes these questions very, very hard to deal with as they should be.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Other telephone calls are invited for our guest this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, tell us about the social movement that led to a change in South Africa. What gave rise to it? How did it work?
There's an organization in South Africa called the Treatment Action Campaign, or TAC, which was formed in 1998. Originally, it formed to fight the pharmaceutical companies about patents, and the government was on its side, and governments and TAC fought primarily a court-based campaign together to against drug patents to bring the price down of ARVs. Then under Mbeki, government left the campaign and decided ARVs were no good, and the social movement, the Treatment Action Campaign, turned against governments and fought them. They were quite an extraordinary movement, very colorful, very loud, very creative. They drew heavily on anti-apartheid protest traditions, drew quite heavily on American traditions like ACT UP. They were very inspired by the work that ACT UP had done in the United States. And as a force getting government to deliver ARVs, they were profoundly successful and very good. I think that where they've struggled more is really to speak to black men, to heterosexual black men. You know, in a sense, having an enemy in Thabo Mbeki has allowed us and perhaps allowed the social movement to hide from a very formidable task of talking to young men about sex. So the social movement has been very powerful, very good, but it has weaknesses. And I think those weaknesses come out in Sizwe's test. You know, Sizwe's first sight of the social movement is when they arrive in his village to do a morning of voluntary testing. And he hears these people saying, it's okay if you test positive, it's okay if people know these drugs which are going to make you better, you're not going to die. What that reminded him of was centuries of cults that have come through his village, religious healing cults saying, join our prophets and your sicknesses will be gone. It smacked of craziness to him. It smacked of something cult-like, and he fled from it. And I think that's because he was a young man feeling shame. And if you're feeling shame over this virus and a group of young people come and tell you that it's okay to be positive, it's okay to join us and you'll be okay, it just makes him very, very wary. It makes him flee.
Let's take another call. A listener south of Champaign, line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
What are the restrictions on the people to come to United States from South Africa? Do they have any testing for AIDS, or is it just overlooked?
Is the question whether people can come to the United States to test for AIDS?
I think the question is, people coming to the United States from South Africa, are they tested?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
No. There's no provision to test people for HIV coming to the United States.
Yeah. Let's go back to the issue of shame and this, you know, people coming along and saying it's okay if people know. You've got shame, you've got that message, but, you know, it's like, no, I don't think it's okay if everybody knows. You've got the issue of disclosure.
Yeah.
How do people find their way around these that issue, disclosure?
Well, it's such a hard one because these are villages and one can't hide. If one gets sick, everybody knows. You know, if you go and test, you could try and go and test in a discreet manner, but it's very unlikely that you won't bump into somebody you know at the clinic. So Doctors Without Borders' attitude to that was to say, well, forget about confidentiality. You know, whether by mistake or consciously people are going to disclose, there's no choice. So rather build a strong, loud social movement and tell people that when they test positive, they can join that movement and it'll be affirming. And they'll feel okay. And perhaps that was the right way to go, I don't know. But it certainly doesn't work for everybody. You know, those feeling deep shame, particularly men feeling deep shame, are going to recoil. More pragmatically on disclosure, the program wouldn't start people on antiretrovirals until they brought a close family member along to be their treatment partner. Who knows much about the drugs as the person on the drugs did, because it's something that's very, very difficult to do alone. That's another issue. I think that disclosing to somebody close to you is an essential part of surviving, and that part of the program was correct. As for the part of the program that insisted on loudness, on embracing a social movement when one tests positive, that's a hard one. It definitely did leave people out. It made some people run away.
Yeah. Because for some people, wearing a T-shirt that says HIV positive is a non-starter.
It is. Look, that's a very powerful campaign. I mean, it took its inspiration from what happened in Denmark during World War II, where the Nazis occupied the country and wanted to identify Jews. And the country's response was for everybody to wear the tribal so that nobody who is Jewish could be distinguished from anybody else. It's a wonderful sentiment. It was a powerful campaign. But you've got to think about those who are going to recoil, as you say. And perhaps the answer there is to present a different face to them, is to present the virus and its treatment as something quite routine, something which is really denuded of meaning, of all that fraught, tense political meaning. You want a sort of treatment environment where things calm down, where things are quiet, where things are relatively private, where it just seems like another chronic illness. know, for those feeling shame, it's important to present an environment where there's no space for that shame to be bounced back at them.
Hmm. For people who are reluctant to test or who do not test, in the back of their minds, they must wonder, what do I do if I become ill?
Yeah, and I think many are doing what Sizwe did, and he said to himself, I think I've got this virus. I really hope I don't have it. Let me not go out and look for it. No, by testing, I'm going out to look for it. I'll sit back, I'll wait, hopefully I don't have it, and if I get sick, then I'll go and get the drugs as a last resort, as a desperate measure. I think that that's very typical. It's absolutely understandable. It's a level of denial which is quite primordial and deep, and we all have it. Its problem is twofold. I mean, one is that one must know whether one's positive or negative because one can spread the virus. And for that reason, it's important to know. You know, Sizwe had a wife who he was sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another is that if you wait until you're sick, it could be too late, especially in an area that Sizwe lives in, which has very poor hospital care. You can be unfortunate in that first sickness turns out to be fatal despite the fact that you go into the drugs. So I understand the attitude he took. It just could end badly.
Given that he was so looking forward to having children, is that a way to get away from the idea of one's personal shame and think about the next generation?
Well, it was because he was so invested in the idea of having children that he didn't want to know.
Yeah. To me, that doesn't make sense, but that's the way it is, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the idea that he was poisoning the next generation was frightening him more than anything else. And kind of if he knew he was doing that, everything would end for him. All meaning in his life would end. I mean, if he was in denial, that was the one thing he really didn't want to know, that he was going to give it to his children.
Hmm. Did he talk about this with his wife?
Yes, they had an incredibly open relationship. I mean, not in front of me. These are things people talk
sure.
about themselves. But just from talking to them separately, there was very little that he feared. He kept secret from his wife. He had a very, very powerful relationship with her, and they loved one another a great deal. And in fact, I mean, shortly after they met, he took a decision to become monogamous, which among young men was fairly unusual. There's a word in Xhosa, its home language, called isishimane, which strictly means a man who's scared of women. But it came to mean a man with only one girlfriend. And there was a great deal of machismo and bravado among men in their late teens and early 20s to be sleeping with several women at once. And he said, no, it's upsetting this woman enormously, and I'm not going to sleep with others. So that was interesting. His decision to become monogamous wasn't just about AIDS. It was also about love and spoke to a very deep and powerful relationship he had with his prospective wife.
Yeah. Is there a parallel here between Sizwe's experience in this regard and between the American homosexuals and a seeming move toward monogamy?
Well,
and the push for marriage?
It's a hard one. You know, I'm not sure exactly what forces in this country have reshaped gay sexual culture so profoundly, and why it's so much a norm among gay men in the country now to adopt children, to marry. AIDS must be part of it, but I don't know if it's the greater part of it. You know, I think there could be many other factors involved too. And as for Sizwe, I think his turn to monogamy is fairly unusual, unfortunately, in his context. I think it makes him an unusual man. You know, we are still spreading 1,000 new infections a day in South Africa. Sexual practice hasn't changed very much. So as things stand, it doesn't look like, you know, AIDS is producing a movement towards monogamy in South or Southern Africa. Whether monogamy is the answer, you know, whether it's monogamy and not something else which is going to prevent AIDS is a question of debate.
Yeah.
You know, it, just speak of it. I mean, forgetting any sort of ethical or cultural issue, just looking at the science of it, at the epidemiology of it, it is possible for the majority of people in society to be sleeping with 2-3 people over a long term, as long as they're not having casual encounters at the same time and bringing the virus into that circle. They're not going to spread AIDS very quickly. So, I mean, the question of which sexual practices are going to curtail the epidemic and which aren't are complicated. And, a rigid proposition that only monogamy will do it might not be right.
Right, right, right. What do you hope people will take away from this book?
Well, I'm thinking of an American audience now in particular. For South Africans, it's different. But for an American audience, you know, I present a man in a world which is very, perhaps, exotic and very foreign. There's belief in witchcraft. There's a belief in that one's ancestors are watching over one. And I hope that by the end of the book, a lot of that exoticism is peeled away and what's left of the human being very much like the reader. And I hope that I've achieved that. And yes, essentially that, you know, this is an epidemic inhabited by people not that dissimilar from Americans inside.
I felt that way, and I have to tell you that I haven't read carefully every page of the book, but I do feel that Sizwe, I feel what I have read of him is that there are so many similarities between how different our culture is. Once you take that away, there are similarities between us. We are, you know, alike in our desires for a good life.
A good life and you know, in this book's case, a good death and a good life after one's death, in the sense that he was so concerned about what he left on this earth after he was dead. And that is clearly universal. That's something that's a crisis all of us face in one way or another. And I like to think that that issue is at the heart of the book.
Yeah. One last question before we go. I understand that you are, according to the biographical sketch on the jacket, that you're currently writing a book about immigrants in New York. And I would imagine these are new immigrants. Who are they? And you want to tell us a little bit about that project?
It's very early days, but I'm writing a book about a community of Liberian, primarily refugees, who are living in a housing project in Staten Island. They've come from one of Africa's most brutal civil wars, where in a country of 3 million, about a quarter of a million people were killed. They generally began arriving in the early 90s. There are about 5,000 of them, all really packed together in one housing project, living among African-American neighbors. And one of the things I want to explore is the process of immigration, I guess, that most immigrants coming to a new country draw strength by drawing back on themselves and ethnic memories, national memories, histories. They essentially, when you leave your home country, you become more yourself in order to make it in the new country, in order to build solidarity. And these people can't, because they've come from a civil war which has estranged them from each other. And, you know, they're there in this housing project, and you don't ask your next-door neighbor what part of Liberia he or she is from and what they were doing 10 years ago. The question's too loaded. So I guess I'm trying to follow how people become Americans under very hard circumstances. Mm.
Johnny Steinberg, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Johnny Steinberg is the author most recently of Sizwe's Test, A Young Man's Journey Through Africa's AIDS Epidemic. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.